Welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 17th of August, 1995, and it's a Thursday. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Bob Ekblad, and he will be speaking on God's welcome to the feast in the new land, welfare and or Christian hospitality. So let's listen in on Bob.
I am a Presbyterian pastor. I work in Burlington, Washington. And that's just south of Bellingham. And my work is to work with migrant farm workers as I'm trying to start an ecumenical ministry with mainly Lutheran, United Methodist, Presbyterian, and Catholic support to migrant farm workers and permanent Hispanic residents in Skagit County. And I also work as the chaplain at the county jail. So I'm also finishing a doctoral dissertation in Old Testament. So. One of the things I like to do is lead Bible studies and sort of bring the text into relationship with kind of current problems and issues that we're facing. So that's what I want to try to do today, is look at the question of our response to immigrants and sort of the homeless and people in our midst, and try to read it or discuss that response in relationship to this, to a familiar text. And today's text that I want to look at is a pretty well-known passage. It's some people would call it the prodigal son. Others would call it the father with two sons. I think that's a better way to read it, since the bad guy in the story isn't necessarily the prodigal son.
No, there could be the son that was chosen tenderly.
Yeah, right. And so I'd like to invite you all to turn to Luke 15, verses 32 to 30, or 11 to 32. Now, for those of you who weren't here yesterday, which looks like most of you, yesterday I did a study on the reconciliation of Jacob and Esau. You know, you have Jacob and Esau, this is a familiar story as well, where you have this struggle in the womb, right? At this, when Rebecca she notices that some major turmoil is going on inside of her, and she goes to inquire of the Lord, and she gets this dream or this word that says two nations are struggling in your womb, and two peoples are in you fighting, and the older will serve the younger. Okay, so there's this sort of sets the scene for understanding the rest of the story, the struggle between Jacob and Esau, which is really the beginning of this whole discussion of election and rejection that goes all the way through the scriptures. You know, Jacob represents the people of Israel, and Esau represents the rejected, the Gentiles, okay? And one thing that shocked me when I did that study was how many parallels there were to that story and the story of the father with the two sons. And I want to sort of allude to those or bring those together in some way, because I think Luke probably desired to make that connection as well. And I think but I want to talk about election and rejection in a modern sense. You know, now we don't think of election in terms of the Jewish people and rejection in terms of the Gentiles. What would be a modern way to talk about election and rejection? Who are the elect?
Rich.
Okay. So, and the rejected?
Poor.
That's right.
Homeless.
You know, that isn't that far from the way that it would have been understood in ancient Israel. You know, the elect were people who were blessed of God, who were blessed with prosperity. You know, the blessing that Jacob receives from his, he receives both a birthright, or he doesn't receive it, he grabs it, he takes it by force, both a birthright and a blessing. Okay, and the birthright and the blessing both included all kinds of material benefits. In fact, that's mainly what they really are. It's just a kind of a description of incredible blessing. And we oftentimes forget that. We usually think of election and rejection in terms of salvation or damnation. But really the idea is very inclusive of just the material reality that we experience as well. So it's not far-fetched at all to think of election in terms of economic benefit. You know, we are the elect in the sense that we're from the first world, or you know, the northern hemispheric countries, we're wealthier. and others are the rejected because they somehow weren't born into a situation where they had their basic opportunities for education and minimal health care and all the different basic needs. Anyway, Luke does something different with this, and hopefully we'll get into it. I just wanted to preface what we're talking about, or preface this talk on with that before we get into the text. So why don't we read chapter 15? And I'd like to begin with chapter 15, verse 1 and 2, because I think that sets the tone for understanding the parable of the man with the father with two sons. Could someone read for us chapter 15 of Luke, verses 1 and 2?
Now the tax collector and sinners were all drawing near to him, and the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them."
Right. So he told them this parable, okay? And this begins a series of three different parables, right? The first one is the man who has 100 sheep and lost one. The second one is the woman who has 10 silver coins and lost one. And the third one is the man with two sons. And we oftentimes read this, we oftentimes do not read this parable in the light of that in verses 1 and 2, which is the whole purpose of the story, right? Mm-hmm. So, the tax collectors and sinners were drawing near to hear him. And what upset these Pharisees the most was that Jesus was eating with them. And, eating with someone in ancient times in Palestine, and even now, actually, in the Middle East, to eat with someone it signifies your total acceptance of them. It's like a gesture of completely embracing someone. And in this time, the Jews were considered to be they had to purify themselves, wash their hands, and ceremoniously sort of prepare themselves for eating, for going into the temple, for all sorts of different, their religious life and secular life, and not so religious life. And one of the things they couldn't do was to eat with sinners, with Gentile sinners who were impure, because that was a way that they could defile themselves. And so Jesus eating with these people was a very radical act. And I was really shocked. In France, we lived for 3 years, and we had a Syrian family that we got to know at this Orthodox church that we were attending. And the Syrians, we really hit it off with them the first time we met them, and they invited us to coffee. Then we invited them to coffee, and then a couple weeks later, they invited us again to coffee. And we kind of kept inviting each other to coffee and pastries and talking and developing this friendship. Then one day, after we'd known them about 6 months, the man came to our house and he said, "I want to know if you would be willing to come and to eat with us." And we said, "Oh, that would be wonderful." So they set a date and we came to eat at their home. And they had this huge banquet spread, incredible food, all laid out for us. And we all sat down. I couldn't believe it. I didn't even want to describe what it was because it'll make us all salivate here. But before the prayer, the man said, in our culture, when we eat with someone, it's like saying that we consider you family and we totally embrace you. And then he said this prayer. And I thought, that really struck me as something that sheds light on this text in many ways, So anyway, we have the context. There's a fence. The Pharisees, the scribes, the religious sort of leaders and intelligentsia of Jesus' time are offended by this. Theologically, this is almost a blasphemous kind of thing. So let's read the story now of the man with the two sons in the light of that. Someone read starting in verse 11, all the way to 24 maybe.
And he said there was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the share of property that falls to me." And he divided his living among them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took his journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in loose living. And when he spent everything he had, a great famine arose in that country, and he began to be in want. So he went and joined himself to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into the fields to feed swine. And he would gladly have fed on the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. And he would gladly have fed on the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, and I perish here with hunger? I will rise and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. And he rose and he came to his father. But while he was still in a distance, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and make merry. For this was my son who was dead and is alive again. He was lost and he's found. And they began to make merry.
Okay, so here we have sort of part one, or scene, maybe scene one and scene two of the story. I was mentioning in the beginning about the elect and the rejected, you know. For Jacob and Esau, you had the firstborn. Okay, Esau is the... Esau is the firstborn. And Jacob is the secondborn. Jacob is the elect, right? Okay, now here you have a complete reversal in the New Testament, where the firstborn become sort of the elect, because they are Jacob, and the secondborn are described as the rejected, who here in this sense, in this text, represent the Gentiles. You have almost a complete switching. And I think what Luke is trying to do is read this, rather than reading it in terms of the Jews and the Gentiles. Instead of reading the firstborn as the rejected, he's assuming that the firstborn are the people of Israel who have the power and have everything, and it's the secondborn who now suddenly are sort of the underdogs. Secondborn, okay. And you can see this because you see this all these incredible connections between Jacob and parallels between Luke and Genesis 27. Like some of the two that you could see would be in Luke 15 you have the father with the two sons. In Genesis 27 to 33 you have Isaac, who has two sons, Esau and Jacob, right? Here's the first obvious parallel. Then in Luke 15, you have the youngest who asked for his inheritance. Okay, in Genesis, you have Jacob demanding his inheritance. Right? This is the second, the youngest. And in Greek, if you compare the Greek of Luke and of Genesis, the youngest one is the very same word exactly in both the Septuagint and the New Testament. And then there's a number of other connections, like the father kisses his son. In Luke, Isaac is kissed by, or kisses Jacob. And then later in the reconciliation, Esau comes running and kisses his brother Jacob. Anyway, I don't want to dwell on this too much, but I can give you a lot of other examples. But the two texts are directly tied. And so anyway, what... if we were to analyze verses 11 all the way until the turning, the turning of the younger son back towards the father, what would be some of the modern equivalents we could give to this sort of parable?
Well, your first son can go to high school and then go to college, go to grad school, and the second son after high school says, I don't want to do all that. Give me the money that you gave my older brother to go to school and let me travel around the world and see what I want to see.
Okay. Yeah, that would be a definitely a modern equivalent. Anything else people can think of?
Well, you have the oldest child that would probably be, like she said, a very responsible person.
Firstborn, those are.
You know, a lot of the times they are. You know, and then you have the younger one who is, he wants to goof off. He wants to travel. He wants to do this. Maybe he gets involved with, you know, drinking, or maybe he starts fooling around with drugs or something like that, and kind of messes himself up.
Okay, so you have you know, the responsible and the irresponsible,
right,
that are present here. What what else could we say?
What about the generations? If you look at the younger generations, they're usually oftentimes looked at as being as squandering their lives, squandering their inheritance, whatever that might be, and running around doing things that are objectionable to those who are in the older generation.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so you have, if we were to look at our society and we were to look at who would be the younger sons, we would definitely see the sort of the youth in the, actually all over in the suburbs as well as the inner city. You know, I think of the church that I pastored in San Francisco. I was the interim pastor of an inner city church, and all my youth group, they were all members of gangs. And you know, the first week I was there, I had to go before the judge because one of them had pulled a gun on, you know, at the high school, on the security guard or whatever. And they were just they were all latchkey kids, you know, kids whose parents worked usually two full-time jobs and were never present. But these kids were almost ungovernable. You know, they were completely, almost impossible to work with. Who would be the others that would fit this category in our society?
Well, I know when on the Indian reservations, especially back in the 40s and 50s, when they were getting oil rights, especially in the South, they gave them money for the oil rights. And some of them would buy Cadillacs, and then they would put their tomato plants in them to plant, you know, to grow them. I mean, in another book I read, they want a swimming pool, and they had the swimming pool put in, but they moved into it as a house because it was better than the house that they had before. So they used things in a way that was not how we would use them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think those on reservations.
Yeah, right. That's true. I mean, you think we have two Indian reservations right near our house, and you know, almost everyone is. One of the greatest problems in that community is all the fetal alcohol syndrome kids, you know, that are born into so many of the families, you know, because of the problem of alcoholism on both those reservations. And they're all living in housing that's completely state, you know, subsidized, and you know, they've been kind of given just piles of aid and support from the state, and you know, they're just in a situation of real. I mean, really, it's killed them in many ways. I mean, their culture's been, they've lost their culture, and the American culture isn't a satisfying replacement. But they've been given all kinds of handouts. And those handouts haven't completely. I mean, they've helped some members of the tribes, but others, it's just created an incredible dependency. In this, if we look at this story, it's pretty clear that the tax collectors and the sinners are the equivalent of the younger son, right? It's you know, so the tax collectors and sinners of Jesus' day, you know, This comparison invites us to look at who the tax collectors and sinners would be of our day, you know, in terms of looking at who the younger son might be. The people who I work with in Skagit County are all people that would fit this description. You know, I just so happen to get, since I'm working with migrant workers, almost all the migrant workers are people who, you know, who travel from, they come up through Mexico, and most of them are illegal, they're undocumented. So they come up and they they work as picking berries, picking raspberries, or first strawberries, then raspberries, then blueberries, and then the cucumber harvests, and then potatoes, sorting the potatoes, and then from there they usually go down to to California for the winter and do other agricultural work. Some go back to Mexico, but almost all these people are illegal. And so, and most of them don't have, they're driving around, but they don't have licenses, driver's licenses, and they don't have insurance. And so when they get pulled over, you know, they get a ticket for $450 for not driving insurance and $450 for not having a driver's license. And they're given a court date. And they're afraid to go to the courts because they think that the courts are tied in with the immigration authorities who would take them and deport them. So they don't go to the courts and they get, so the amount of money that they owe goes up because they don't show up and they don't pay. And then they get a warrant out for their arrest. And so the next time they're picked up, they go into the county jail. Well, most of these people don't claim, most of them aren't married to the people they live with, and they have an average of anywhere between 3 and 6 children. And they have their families all living in apartments or in migrant camps. And so when the Border Patrol person says, well, you married? They say, no. And of course, they're not lying because they're not married. And what they do is so the Border Patrol deports them. They send them down. First they do their time in the jail, and then they're sent down to a huge prison in Seattle. And in the prison, they spend maybe 3 or 4 days before they're handcuffed to a bus, you know, a seat of a bus, and along with about 70 others, and they're sent down to Tijuana. Well, meanwhile, their family is sitting there with no income in some apartment and no way to pay rent. And sometimes the wife is legal, or maybe she's a U.S. citizen. And the children have all been born in the United States, so they're all U.S. citizens. And so some of them get on the welfare rolls and are that's their only alternative because they've been separated from their husbands. So anyway, their husbands are en route down to Mexico, and there's no way those men are going to stay down there. And if they can't manage to make it back up, then of course their families are stranded, and the woman, looks for some other relationship and ends up, you know, with some more kids. And anyway, these are the kinds of people that I work with in terms of the Hispanic ministry. And then the Anglo ministry, or the Hispanic, you know, in the jail, of course, you can imagine what that would be. You know, there's people who are in there for rape, for selling cocaine, for selling heroin, for, you know, for drive-by shootings. They're all sort of the people who our society would just as soon see put away and or disappeared or you know. They're people that oftentimes, it's not at all their first time in the jail. It's maybe their, for some of them, it's their 15th or 20th time, you know. And for others, it's rarely it's their first time. In fact, I don't think I've ever met anyone in the jail yet who was there just for the very first time. You know, they cycle in and out and in and out. And so, and they're oftentimes people who've had opportunities, you know. They're not all people who are just the poorest of the poor. Some of them, especially the Anglos, are people who have who've had good money, but then they've gotten into using cocaine, and they haven't been able to, you know, they've gotten addicted to cocaine, so they've sold everything they've had, and they've hawked, they've taken a lot of their parents' valuables to pawn shops and lived off that, and used their parents' Visa cards and, you know, and stolen money and, you know, done all kinds of things, broken into cars, and, you know, a lot of times they'll tell me, they'll say, you know, I'm in here for a warrant for not paying a traffic ticket, but thank God they didn't get me for all the stereos that I stole out of cars and all the, you know, all the other crimes that I've committed, all the houses I've broken into in the last 2 years. And anyway, what I find is that there's a tremendous resistance among the Anglo community that I work with to having anything to do with these folks. You know, there's a tremendous feeling of frustration. You know, these tax collectors and sinners are people who, I mean, these are people who the whole society is feeling a tremendous frustration about. And I'm wondering how to articulate sort of how we need to reach out and respond to these people, to the churches. So one of the things that I want to do in looking at the parable, this parable together, is to try to explore together and to get some of your ideas about how we can talk about the feast, the banquet. You know, here in this story, we have the image of the banquet. You know, the father kills the fatted calf, and the dancing and the merriment begin, and it's a feast. It's in a way, it's a parable of the feast of the kingdom. You know, we could call this parable the parable of the feast for the younger son, as well as we could a parable of the prodigal son, depending on how we look at it. So, anyway, what happens to this younger son in this story? What can we talk more about, just the stages of what happens to this younger son?
This particular younger son repents.
Okay.
And he goes home and he asks his father for forgiveness.
Okay, what's the nature of this repentance? What happens?
What happened?
Mm-hmm.
Gets hungry, needs a job.
Okay, so this person sort of hits bottom.
Mm-hmm. Says he came to himself before he repented, that something happened to it, a light bulb went on.
Mm-hmm.
Where else is this parable? Isn't it this parable in another gospel?
No, this is the only place.
Well, he saw that he was living a whole lot worse off than even his father's servants.
Mm-hmm.
He recognized that parallel there, mm-hmm. that comparison.
Okay.
And figured he could do better if he went home.
Okay.
But he could have even gone home and been one of his father's servants. He would have been happy. At least he would have been fed.
Right. Now, where do you say, someone said there's repentance here. Where do you see that in the text?
Where he says, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you.
Okay, but I mean before you, that's when he's already gotten back to his father, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are the stages of, let's try to outline a little bit closer the stages of what happens.
Well, he saw that the pigs were eating better than he was. And as it says here, he came to himself and he realized that his father's hired servants were eating better than he was. He wasn't eating anything.
But before that, where he lived, they had a famine, and he didn't cause the famine.
No, but he'd already spent all his money.
I know, but still, the famine made it worse.
Okay. So it's like reality sort of hit him from hit him between the eyes, and he was forced to sort of come to grips with the situation. You know, in AA they would say this guy he came to the point where he recognized that he needed a higher power, or you know, he came to the point where he couldn't through his own means save himself, and finally bottomed out. Okay, so his first impression is then that his father's hired servants are better off than he, and this is what leads him to return. Does that sound like repentance right there?
No, it can't sound like survival.
Sounds like survival, exactly. So what would be the modern equivalent of, I mean, what would be the modern equivalent of that sort of a move?
I plead guilty, so you get an easier sentence.
Yeah, right. Pleading guilty instead to get an easier sentence. What else?
Going on welfare is better than starving.
Yeah, exactly. So this isn't really that noble of a move on his part.
Well, he had a job. It's just that it didn't pay well enough for him to eat. Because he said he went to, joined himself to one of the citizens of that country who sent him to the fields to feed the swine. Well, I assume that this was a volunteer job.
Yeah.
Of course, he could have taken a few of the things that he was feeding the swine and eaten them.
That's
obvious. But I don't see how welfare ties in with this. He had a job, decided he could get a better job with his father that would feed him far better than he was eating while he was feeding the swine. To me, it was just a switch in jobs, which people do all the time, trying to better themselves. They've got a job that pays nothing.
Okay, but he's coming back to the father. Is he coming back to the father as a son?
No, he's coming back. He thinks that the father has written him off because he squandered his inheritance, and he's going back to the owner of a business, let's say, and saying, you know, hire me back. I need a job, and you know I'm not worthy to be part of the family anymore, but won't you hire me to work in the factory?
But he's coming to the father in terms of merit. He wants to merit. He's not. He's not looking at the father as someone who is his right. Is he doesn't. He's not thinking in terms of deserving. Like he left in the first place. His image of the father was my father owes me this inheritance. Mm-hmm. Okay. His vision of the father is clearly one of. Why don't we look at who his father is from the beginning to the end? His image of the father. First of all, it's the one who owes him. Owes him an inheritance, mm-hmm. right? Okay, so it's...
Share the property that falls to me.
At which point the father divided up all of his property to the other son as well.
Okay.
So the other son got his portion as well at that time.
Right, right. So, but that was basically just a legal sort of dividing of what the father had.
And yet that was a great insult in those days.
Yeah, definitely, because normally you
would... To take the property before your father died.
Yeah.
To slap your father in the face.
Right, so it's
and
like...
so everybody knows that you've done this. Yeah.
Okay, so his image of the father was basically like a sugar daddy or something, or someone you could just kind of hit up.
Or is it sort of like the guys in jail stealing from their parents to get the cocaine?
Yeah, well maybe so, in a way. Yeah, except this is more of a legitimate thing that he's doing. He's going and just asking for his what's owed it. Now, when he returns, when he says to himself, "My father's servants have more than what I have," mm-hmm. Is there any change in his image of the father at that point, or is it pretty consistent with this?
No, I don't think so. It's just what he sees is the father's servants mm-hmm. who are better off than he is.
Right.
So it's an easy way to go and get a position because he knows that situation. He knows what the father's servants do, and he knows that they eat well.
Okay, so he still sees the father as someone who's going to give according to a merit. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so really the father is not really a, I mean there's no, we can't say there's any kind of repentance here.
But he says, I will arise and go to my father and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against you, heaven and earth before me, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.
Okay.
But he's already figured out what he can say to his father to get himself a job.
Right,
that's
exactly.
Manipulation.
Exactly. So what there is there's just a he knows what he needs to say to get this position, which is a position of being a hired servant. Mm-hmm. Okay,
he's
so what?
Son again. He's never going to be son again.
He's
he
never
lost that.
That's right.
Because he took that.
So he goes back knowing he cannot be son again.
Mm-hmm. He's never going to be a son by right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So. What happens as he approaches home?
His father saw him
and had compassion.
Okay.
His father saw him and ran and embraced him and kissed him, just like Esau did to Jacob.
He didn't even wait for him to get to the gate.
Right.
So I'm not sure that he's not son anymore.
Well, in his own mind, he's not a son.
Legally, he's not.
Not legally, and in the mind of the son, he's not a son, right?
But the father says
he's my son.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because he had
the parents said, that's my son, regardless of what he's done, that's my child.
Okay, mm-hmm. Right. So at this point, we have a shift. Okay, the son views the father this way. But at this point now, the father is revealing something different. Okay? So now we have... Actually, we could have father number one and then father number two. So this father, when he sees the son coming, he makes a move that way. just in the, with just at the very moment when this son, regardless of the son's motivation, regardless of the son, whether the son is has a legitimate sort of repentance or conversion, or regardless, he doesn't know anything about what the son thinks, right? Has the son said anything to the father before the father embraces him? Okay, so there's absolutely no motive. This father has no knowledge. All we have is that he saw him and he has compassion on him. And the father runs to the son and embraces him. And then what? Then what happens?
Kills the fatted calf.
Before that.
The son said, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son."
He embraced and kissed him first.
Uh-huh, exactly. So the son does make this gesture of sort of contrition. But
not until after his father had adored him, his father loved him.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, at that point, the son did say to him, he might have had it in his head, he was going to manipulate, you know, but when it came right down to it, I think he really meant it.
Does that seem to impact the father's attitude towards the son when he says this?
I don't think it made any difference to the father at all, because he already had kissed him and hugged him.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's amazing, because this father says to the servants, "Bring quickly the best robe." It's like this father doesn't even pay attention to these words. These words are completely irrelevant to the whole event. So,
I wonder what was going on in the son's mind, though. You know, was he really able to accept that immediately? Or was he going, "God, I'm so horrible and I'm just, you know, really bad and stuff," and that the father almost had to convince him? I know we don't have any of this information, but it makes you wonder, did the father have to convince him, or just, you know, did he just forget about the son's responses, or did the son just say, "Okay, cool, this is great, I'm fine," you know? I mean, it's just sort of interesting to think psychologically what was going on in the son's mind.
Yeah, exactly. And the text doesn't really give us that much information about that, so it sort of allows us to speculate or to contemplate.
One Middle Eastern scholar that I've read said that whole gesture of the father seeing his son and running to him was, you saw the character, that a person of his wealth wouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. He embarrasses himself by running toward his son, and what he's actually doing is he saves face of his son in the village. Mm-hmm. And he reinstates him as a Jew. A gracious gesture for him to run and embrace his son before the people in the town start to put him down for the way he's been.
Yeah. And that's Kenneth Bailey. Kenneth Bailey, who's written this book on poet and peasant, I think, and then parables. Beautiful book that kind of reads the parables in the light of the modern peasant in Palestine. That's what he says. That gesture of running is like a total humiliation. For a Middle Eastern man like that, a father.
Yeah, I would like to say I'm probably, in my thinking, you know, quite different from a lot of people. Maybe I'm rebellious, I don't know, but I would like to say that the son is really the migrant workers that you're talking about and the people who are incarcerated, and that the inheritance that they have squandered is their debt to society by not doing what society thinks that they should do. For instance, coming into the country illegally and whatever they're doing to become incarcerated. And that the father, though, on the other hand, is our heavenly father, but as his representative, as Christian people, that we are really the father. That the Father is in us and we are in Him, and so we should be the ones who are running to those people who owe this inheritance. If they're willing to come back, or even if they're not, we should see that they will come to us.
Okay. Yeah, that's a nice connection. And you know, one of the questions that I have that I want, I might as well get to it now. Who is the Father? According to this parable, in the light of the whole chapter,
I always thought it was God,
Heavenly Father.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yahweh.
Now, if we reread chapter 15, verse 1 and 2, does that shed any light on who the Father might be? Could someone read 15 verses 1 and 2?
Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him. And the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them."
So was it Jesus?
To be the church.
Well, who's the one that's eating with the sinners and the tax collectors and is receiving them and welcoming them? Who's drawing near to? Who are the sinners and Pharisees and scribes? I mean, who are they drawing near to?
Jesus.
It's Jesus. So Jesus is the Father is symbolic of Jesus in this text, it seems to me. You know, the Pharisees are. I mean, the parable is meant to illustrate how Jesus reveals the Father. A different kind of father, a completely different kind of father than what sort of the sinners and the tax collectors ever could have imagined. You know, the sinners and the tax collectors imagined a father like this. You know, someone who you have to merit salvation. You know, the Father's not going to love you unless you meet up to the standards of righteousness, of the Torah. You know, if you cannot meet up to those standards, if you cannot obey the Mosaic law to the letter, as the Pharisee of Judaism described that, then you there's no hope for you. You're excluded. Right? So here we have, and you know, one thing that I find amazing is in the jail, I do a Bible study every week in the jail, and everyone, practically, without exception, I can't think of any exceptions really, their image of God is very much this kind of a father. Okay. God is a God who... I'll even say I'm in jail because of God's will. You know, God has me in jail. And there may be some truth to that even. I don't want to just exclude their understanding of their situation, but usually they see God as the God who got a retribution, who's got them there, and oftentimes they will come to the point where they really will bottom out, and they come to a Bible study because they're finally to that point where they think, okay, well, maybe if I turn to God, I'll get out of this situation of difficulty. But turning to God means, first of all, that they know they have to go to Bible study and start praying and make promises that they're not going to use cocaine and heroin or, you know, alcohol, or they want to kind of clean up their life. When they swear, sometimes they'll say, "Oh, excuse me, Pastor," you know, or whatever. It's clear that for them, what they have is a huge list in mind. You know, they have this list of just, you know, all these different sort of behaviors that they have to do, and they figure that they're in jail because they haven't measured up to God, you know, and they consider God and the system as sort of synonymous, you know. So when they go before the judge and the judge says, "You have 7 years," you know, they just finished praying that God would give them, you know, 3 years instead of 7 years, and then they go before the judge and they get 7 years. Okay, so that's, in their minds, that's God. Most of them do not see any discontinuity between, I mean, they have no image of this father. That father's completely, they're completely ignorant of that father.
So then the older brother is Pharisees and scribes.
Yeah, well, why don't we read that section now? Could someone read for us chapter, the same chapter 15, verses 25 to 32?
Now his elder son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what this meant. And he said to him, "Your brother has come, and your father has killed a fatted calf because he has received him safe and sound." But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, "Lo, these many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a kid that I might make merry with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your living with harlots, you killed for him the fatted calf." And he said to him, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It is fitting to make merry and to be glad, for this your brother was dead, and he is alive. He was lost and is found."
All right, so someone just pointed out that the older brother in this story is sort of symbolic of the Pharisees and the scribes. who criticized Jesus for eating with tax collectors and sinners. So who would be the modern equivalent of the elder son?
Us.
In the light of what we're trying to talk about.
Us.
Yeah, I'd like to say us too, and just to say that I don't know how to put this without going into a lot of the extraneous details, but it seems as though a certain segment of the population, such as the youth who are in gangs and, as you pointed out, the migrants, probably some of the migrant workers or those who are incarcerated, are being shunned by people who might have been like them at one time but became Christians and went on to be involved in their own church or church setting, but yet turn a back on those who are in the situation that they were in. So that's just, you know, that's even being more specific than saying the church as a particular kind of church. Mm-hmm. Seems like they're being neglected and overlooked and shunned by probably the total church, but especially by those who probably would know how to help them even more so than just the church at large.
Yeah, exactly.
Perhaps those who follow convention, for example, I've done what my parents expected of me. I followed the rules. I went to school, was a good kid. Didn't get into trouble, got a job. I've earned my way to comfort. That might be the second.
Yeah, exactly. I think of myself sometimes, I find myself driving around with these migrant farm workers, and, you know, and I can't help but sort of be a little bit judgmental. I think, well, God, I mean, look at that. They're driving without a driver's license. I mean, can't they at least go and get a driver's license? And they're driving without insurance. What if they hit me on the highway? You know, and luckily I have uninsured motorist insurance or whatever. But, you know, it's like there's a tremendous sort of irresponsibility. And it's easy to be critical, easy to be judgmental. I mean, you know, why can't they just follow the rules like I follow the rules? You know, and maybe these people should be just thrown in prison so that they will finally realize that they just have to be grow up and be responsible. You know, it's very, very, that voice is definitely part present in me.
But aren't they being responsible because they've left home to go and earn money for mm-hmm. their family so they can send it back to them? And if they do go and get a driver's license, they're going to be recognized as being undocumented and being kicked out of the country?
Well, that's right. They do fear that they're going to be represented as undocumented, because in our area, the Border Patrol oftentimes shows up at the jail, and when someone who's illegal is visiting their relative who's in jail who's illegal, they will pick up that person who's visiting their relative and deport them. So people are afraid to go to the jail, and the courthouse where they have to pay your tickets is right in the jail building, same building. So there is a legitimate fear of going and paying your ticket.
Well, there are a lot of people who drive without insurance too.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not just undocumented mm-hmm. people that drive without insurance. With the cost of insurance the way it is these days, there are a lot of people who are on the border that are earning, but who are on the, kind of on the border of, you know, is it food or is it the insurance payment, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So there are a lot of people who drive without insurance, even that's against the law.
Well, in some areas too, it's like you said, the money, the cost of living is more, the housing's more. You'll find some of these families living 3-4 families in one house just in order to make it. And then they still don't have money for insurance because it's just too expensive.
It is, exactly. So one of the things that I find myself tremendously frustrated at this point in my work, because all the people that I'm working with pastorally are people that have sort of needs that are just, that are overwhelming. And when I try to contact the churches, first of all, want to know what, would rather that the person would go to the welfare office and sort of get their needs met there, or to go to the local food bank that they contribute to, or that would go to the local shelter. And those are all legitimate sort of agencies that would help these people, but there's a lot of people that don't. What I find is that there's a sort of an arm's length sort of, mm-hmm. I don't want to be involved. There's people who are afraid to be involved with these people, and there's a repulsion. And they'd rather have have some kind of intermediary between themselves and these people. And I understand that. There's fear of the unknown. There's, I just want to throw out two examples of people that I've run into in the last month. One is a woman who's, her husband is in, who's been charged with rape, and he's undocumented. No, he's a documented Mexican person who is going to go to jail for 7 years. And he asked me to visit his wife. She lives in a little trailer and has three kids, one of whom is mentally handicapped, and she's undocumented, so she cannot apply. All she can apply for is, or she can't apply for even WIC, because you have to, in order to get WIC, women, infants, children, you know, the milk and cereal, you have to either be pregnant or have a young child. So the only thing that she can get is, if there's a crisis, she has medical care, because the state does support her in that way. But she has to work to pay her $300 a month space for her trailer and to buy her food. And what she does to work is she depends on friends who drive her out to the raspberry fields to pick raspberries, and she can make about $25 a day picking raspberries. But that doesn't even hardly cover her. I guess there are places where she can leave her kids in the day for childcare, but she doesn't have a car to take her kids to that place. And she has no car to get to the raspberry field, so she's totally dependent upon people who she knows to drive her to all these different places. And it's just in an absolute bind. So what do I do? You know, how do I find collaborators to sort of support this person? You know, she can't speak a word of English, and the food bank people, none of them speak Spanish, and the homeless shelter in our area, no one speaks Spanish. Okay, so she's absolutely in this bind, and there's so many people, many, many, many people in our communities that are in these same sorts of situations. And I see these people growing. It's a growing sort of presence in our society.
I pray that you won't be frustrated with that ministry, because I really feel like the Spirit of the Living God is moving on your behalf and on the behalf of people who are in those ministries. Now, I came here to pray during my time here about such ministries, and I really didn't know what form the answer to the prayer would be, but I know God has put it on the heart of my church to do something with migrant workers and people who are in trouble with the law, the very two things that you're talking about, mm-hmm. young people specifically, who are having problems with police and the law and so on. And I know for a fact that came from God, and we've just been praying, because we're a small ministry, but we support other ministries, and, you know, through prayer, of course, but also financially. And I know if it's on our heart, it's got to be out there as well. And so I think that God, I know God is on your side, and I just pray that you won't be discouraged.
No, I'm discouraged only because I see the fear level in the communities and among the Anglo churches that I work with. People are terrified to get involved in these situations that seem like they're just going to be a huge drain, and that there's no solution. And I see two things, you know, people are saying,
but don't you see it as a drain too right now? I mean, can you give them some options that won't be a drain? Do you have some options that you can suggest if you do these Bible studies with the churches in Mount Vernon and Burlington? Do you have some ideas you can give them? Because if you give some churches some ideas, they'll go with them. It's when you tell them this and they feel, what are we going to do? They can keep having babies and none of them speak English. And, you know, and a lot of people aren't about to learn a second language right now, but maybe there's a Spanish teacher. Or, you know, there's other options if they get together and you give them a problem to solve. Mm-hmm. But you got to do these Bible studies with them.
Exactly. No, I agree. One of the things that I find, though, is that there's two, there's an attitude right now in our society, and I see it everywhere, that we have to minimize the amount of subsistence, kind of welfare support for people. And I see that it's already most of the people I work with have no access to welfare because they're illegal, okay? Well, and they have nothing back in Mexico to go back to. It's worse, their situation back in Mexico would be worse than what I just described, because they have nothing. They never had land, perhaps. They lived in the capital city. You know, Mexico City has millions and millions of people and terrible poverty. And so they're not going to go back there. They feel like their situation, even in this kind of a trailer situation where they can pick raspberries for $25 a day, that's far better than their situation in Mexico. So they don't want to go back, and that's not really an alternative. And yet they have no access to state assistance. And the church is basically at this place of paralysis of not really knowing, you know, what to do. But most of the church members don't want, you know, want their taxes lowered and don't want to see these people receiving any benefits. And so I guess that's why I brought up that phrase, my title of my talk, you know, the welcome, God's welcome to the banquet, welfare or Christian hospitality. What, you know, what do we need to, how do we need, how can we address these sorts of issues, you know?
I think I know in San Diego County, several years back, they got together and formed these resource centers, they call them down there. And this is why you were talking about the pastors keeping this at arm's length. There are professionals out there who do this, who when you direct somebody to a resource center, they find out, are you in need of shelter, food, clothing? What are your needs? Mm-hmm. Where each individual pastor at each individual church, about 5-6 years ago, we found that the same professional beggars, not necessarily Hispanics, certainly, people appearing to be homeless were going from church to church and receiving handouts from the discretionary fund. So the pastors got together and said, you know, well, we need to stop this. So they just started directing people to the resource centers, which is backed and helped and funded somewhat by the churches and the people in the churches. So, you know, it's, I know what you're saying about the pastors keeping at arm's length, but it's also a better way, it's more of a clearinghouse to get people to the services that they need.
Definitely. Yeah, and I see a definite place for that. But at the same time, I see several things happening here. Here you have, in this text anyway, you have both a feast, a banquet, you know, a robe. I mean, this, the father's bringing this guy a robe. He's bringing him, he's killing the fatted calf. There's a banquet. So there's concrete sort of physical things that are being offered to this person who has returned to the father. But at the same time, there's a totally new image of the father that is being revealed to this individual, which is really the most liberating, even as or equally liberating in this story. And how can we articulate, how can we work this sort of a, or communicate this to people?